Welcome to the Boomer Woman's Podcast, where we are embracing the journey. I'm your host, Agnes Knowles. Many of us reach midlife believing we've done the right things. And yes, I just used air quotes. We saved, we worked, we planned. And yet there are financial rules, especially around retirement, that quietly change depending on where you live, how you retire, and when you make certain decisions. What makes this especially tricky is that these rules don't announce themselves. They don't show up as red flags. They tend to surface years later, and often at the exact moment we're ready to slow down, simplify, or finally say yes to a life that looks a little different. In this episode, Jimmy helps us look beneath the surface of retirement planning, particularly for those considering life beyond their home country, and explains why understanding these hidden traps early can mean the difference between flexibility and frustration later on. Listen now to my conversation with Jimmy Miller. If you've ever wondered whether the financial advice you're actually getting fits the life you're living, especially if that life includes more than one country, today's conversation is for you. Jimmy grew up globally. He was born in Zambia and has spent much of his life moving between countries. That gave him a front row seat to how money, taxes, and long-term planning quietly change when borders do. Over time, he noticed something unsettling. Very smart, capable people, especially in midlife, could walk straight into financial surprises they never saw coming. Today, Jimmy helps internationally mobile people make sense of those risks before they become problems. He's known for explaining complicated financial and tax issues in a way that's refreshingly practical and human, and for reminding us that decisions made today can follow us years and countries later. Some of our conversation is specifically American. If you're not, use the issues we discussed today for research purposes in your home country before you set out on international relocation. Jimmy Miller, welcome to the Boomer Woman's Podcast, where we are embracing the journey.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, and let's just tell our audience that you're in Bali right now. I mean, it doesn't get much better than that. That's kind of nice. So financial planning, many of us imagine that financial planning is financial planning. At what point does living or retiring abroad change that assumption?
Yeah, that's a great question. Really, the first second you start to think about going abroad as an American, things start to change. So you have to walk into that kind of situation with wide-eyed open, understanding that America is the only country in the world that taxes its citizens worldwide. So unlike other countries, if you leave and you don't use the roads and the systems and the schools, you can deregister from their tax system. Americans, even if you're living overseas and don't even intend to return to America, you still have to file a tax return in the States. So that complicates the matters. There's a whole extra level of layers on top of that that the IRS requires for Americans overseas, which creates a really specific niche in financial planning that somebody like me, who spent more than half my life overseas myself, is qualified to fill and educate people about.
You just reminded me that at some point in time, I heard that even I'm Canadian. If I live and work in the US for any given point in time, I also like, do you know that? This is, as I say, just reminded me of something that I had heard that I would also have to file some sort of income tax form every year if I were to then leave the US after I've already worked there for a while.
So if a foreigner comes to America while they're in America, they'll be considered a U.S. person for tax purposes. Under most circumstances, there are a few visas that you can come to America, like a student visa, some research grant type visas like a J-1. You don't have to file taxes in America or when you leave. Now, if you're not American and you come to America for a certain period of time and then you leave, that's another whole basket of complications. But generally, when you leave America as a non-US citizen, as long as you don't have a green card, then your tax obligation in America will stop, unless you've created a business that's going to create residual income based in America, or in many instances, you've saved a retirement plan in America, like you had a 401k while you were here, or you started investing while you're in America, and you're leaving some part of your financial life in America when you leave. That will also often trigger tax obligations going forward in America, even after you've left.
Okay, so we're less than 5 minutes in, and I can just see how people need people like you. Holy crikey. Okay, you somewhere in your profile, I saw the term tax time bombs. What does that mean, and how does it affect people in everyday life?
Yeah, so taxes can leave nasty surprises for people, both Americans living in America, Americans overseas, and for foreigners that come to America to work and then eventually want to take the money that they saved in America back to their home country with them. So, I mean, taxes are complicated worldwide, not just in America. That's no secret. And a lot of people don't take the time to really understand how taxes work. And that it's a system set up to take that you can take advantage of if you're really knowledgeable about it. But if you're not, you can set up what I call tax time bombs or tax traps. There's lots of names for them out there that can hit you at times you don't expect. And a lot of that those times is when you need your money the most, like when you're moving back to your home country or when you get to retirement. That's a pretty important time in your life when you need your money the most. And to get tax surprises that you didn't expect to see at those times in your life can destroy a financial plan pretty quickly, in my experience.
Can you explain like what would constitute like what would someone encounter if they were, say, they'd been living and working in the US for 20 years, whatever, and they're going back now to retire in their home country? What sort of surprises? Like how would that possibly affect them?
Yeah, so for expats living in America, when they go home, the biggest mistake that I see is they save in tax deferred retirement accounts. So in America, we have the 401k. Most people are familiar with 401k. So, you know, somebody from Europe comes to America, they on a work visa for 5 years or 10 years, and they're told about this magical thing called the 401k, and they're going to put some money into it, and their employer is going to put a match into it, and it grows in their investment account. And they can save on their taxes if they choose the pre-tax option. So that's not that money's not going to be taxed, and it's going to give them a little bit extra in their paycheck. And so that's what most Americans would do. So that's the advice that they also give their colleagues that have come over from outside of America. And I see this all the time. So they do that, and then 5 years later, or 10 years later, they want to move back to Europe. And of course, they don't plan to return to America, and they want to maybe buy a house in Europe, or and so they want to take their money with them. And they didn't realize when they did that in America, for some reason, the government's picked this magical age of 59 and a half years old to be able to access your money without a 10% early withdrawal penalty. And so, in this situation, when they want to take their money with them, they're not going to only owe tax on every penny that they saved, what they saved, and what the employer put in because it's pre-tax. They're going to get an additional 10% penalty on top of the taxes that they would have to pay on that, oftentimes losing 30, 40, I've seen 50% of the money that they saved while they're in America go to the IRS as they depart for their home country, which in my experience, most of them didn't realize or expect to happen when they leave. So that's a great example of a tax time bomb for an expat in America, you know, only being able to take home, you know, 30 or 40% of the money that you saved while you're here. It's a tough nut to swallow for a lot of them as they move home.
Is there any way around it insofar as, say, they became aware of this and said, okay, I'll leave that money there and I'll just come spend a month in the US and that'll be my living expenses paid for when I'm in the US. Is there anything that they can play with in that regard?
So because it's in a retirement account, they can't even spend it in the US. It's locked up until they're at least 59 and a half. With to get penalty. So there are some ways around it. There's some clever financial planning tricks. So if I meet an expat in America early, I'll encourage them to do the Roth 401k. So that's the tax-free account. In Canada, you have an equivalent tax-free savings account that they can use. It's like the Roth IRA. So in the Roth IRA, anything that they save is after tax. So they don't get a tax break when they put the money in, but all the money that they put in, they can take out at any time with no taxes or penalties. Now, the growth of that money while they're in America is still subject to that, the taxes and the penalties if they don't wait till 59 and a half. But you know, if somebody saves $50,000 and it's grown to 60 and they want to take it with them, the 50 is tax-free, the 50 is penalty-free. It would only be that $10,000 worth of growth that they would either have to leave in America till they were 59 and a half, or if they decide to take that, it would only be the taxes and penalties on that $10,000. And that's a lot less of a hit than, losing 30 or 40% of the entire $60,000. So the Roth IRA is a great trick for expats in America to save their money and be able to take it home with them at the end without getting so much taxes penalties to the IRS.
Okay, so that's good tips for expats in the US. What about US citizens, Americans who say, oh, I'm going to retire to the coast of Spain, and they've still got those 401ks. How do can they draw on it, or do they have to spend a certain amount of time in the US? How does that work?
Well, that's a
We're
good question
jumping right
too.
in here, I tell you. This is
Yeah,
great.
and there's a different ball of worms for each of these groups of people. So the most common tax trap or tax time bomb that I see for that couple, the American couple who want to go live, work, or retire in Europe, say Spain or Portugal, is not understanding that those countries, even the countries that have a tax treaty with America to kind of sort some of these issues out, that those countries won't recognize something like the Roth 401k or the Roth IRA. So in America, a lot of people will save in the Roth account, so it's going to be tax-free, but it's only going to be tax-free in America. So if you make the decision to go to Spain or Portugal or Italy, they're going to tax that tax-free account in America. And the tax rates in some of those countries can be quite high, well, up near 50%. And that stops a lot of Americans from retiring in Europe, in my experience, when they do a side-by-side comparison, which is a lot of what I do for people. And I show them, okay, here's what retirement would look like if you stayed in America. You've done a really great job in saving in all these tax-free accounts, so you're going to have this great income. Now, if you go over and live in Europe, and they're going to tax your 401k, they're going to tax your Roth 401k, your Roth IRA, here's what your tax situation is going to look like. And they're like, really? If I go to Italy, they're going to take 50% of my tax-free account in America? And unfortunately, they will. And that discourages them from moving over there because, as you can imagine, if somebody's planning on retirement and all of a sudden the new location they want to retire to is only going to provide half of the income of what they were planning on, that might not make the retirement as attractive to them. There's also ways around some of that. Some countries are friendlier than others with the tax treaty. There are a couple countries like the UK that will recognize the Roth tax-free status of America, but most countries won't. And if you're in a country that doesn't have a tax treaty, that can be really devastating to the American accounts because then you're going to get a double taxation issue. Most tax treaties are at least designed that even if they do tax you, which is bad enough, you won't pay double tax. So the tax you pay in Spain, for example, or Italy, you can deduct that from your taxes in America. So you're only paying generally the higher of the two countries. When you move to a country that doesn't have a tax treaty, then both countries will want to tax you and you can't write them off between the two. And that's where it gets even more painful. So there's lots of tax traps like that for Americans who want to move overseas or retire overseas, which is been a huge growing trend,
Yeah.
people that want to retire overseas these days.
I can see how that would really be, as you say, a tax trap, because I would expect that I have earned money in, this country here, my home country, and now I'm drawing on that money. I just happen to be living in another country, that the fact that they would then consider it income over there when it's not income. It was income 10 years ago. I don't know. I'm just, yeah, I can see how, boy, oh boy. Could you just for a brief second, explain what a tax treaty is? I mean, I know, but maybe just in case our listeners don't.
Sure. To encourage people to move globally, a lot of countries did create a tax treaty with America to stop some of these double taxation issues. Because obviously, it's not fair if Italy's going to take 50% of your money and then you still have to file back in America and you're still in the 22% bracket in America. You start to add those together and it's a lot of taxes, especially when you pile on, Social Security tax, Medicare tax, the payroll taxes on top of that. You can be left with almost no money. And then some of these countries also then tax your investments differently and then they pile that on top as well. So it would make it impossible. So the US, they seeked out tax treaties with many of the countries around the world to eliminate this double taxation. And each one is negotiated independently with each country about what the country would recognize, what they wouldn't for taxes, who gets what tax on what money. Some countries split it. You know, some countries say, well, you can tax investments in this one and we'll tax the income in this one. And so each one's a little bit different. And so whichever country you're going to, I encourage you to go to the IRS website, look at the tax treaty for that country and see what things you could take advantage of, what taxes might look like if you moved there. They're written in legalese, but they are decipherable for most people to read them and kind of understand the gist of where the taxes are going to go if they move to that particular country. But those help a lot. So there's two things that expats need to look at: the tax treaty, and then there's another treaty called the totalization agreement. Most countries that have a tax treaty also have a totalization agreement, and that agreement is for specifically for Social Security. So one of the tax traps, another tax trap that I see for Americans, a lot of them don't understand or realize that when they get their Social Security someday, they're going to get taxed on it. I see this one all the time. You're like, what, didn't I earn Social Security by paying taxes? Yes, you did. You earned Social Security by paying taxes. And now when you get the benefit, you're going to have to pay taxes on the benefit. And so countries have agreements specifically for that, so that if you're living and working in a country, you're not paying taxes into their Social Security system and taxes into the American Social Security system. Again, that double taxation issue. And then the treaty, the totalization agreement, also dictates which country you can draw benefit from. Does working in Italy help your US Social Security? Does an Italian coming to America help the Italian Social Security benefit? And then each country, again, is different. In a rule of thumb, working in a country with a totalization agreement won't increase your US benefit, but it will help you get over the line to qualify for your US benefits. A lot of people don't realize you have to have at least 10 years of substantial earnings to even qualify to get a Social Security check once you get to retirement age. And so if you spend a lot of your life overseas, like I have, you might not have that 10 years. You know, you might only have 5 years, you know, right after college before you developed an expertise that took you overseas, and then you won't qualify. But many countries you might live in will get you over that 10-year mark. They'll count the years you worked in those countries towards the 10-year mark in America to qualify you for Social Security. So there you go. There's another big complication that you see for Americans who want to go overseas, and why there's advisors like me who specialize in this kind of thing.
Yeah, I have a Canadian friend who lived and worked in Canada for a number of years, has retired to a tropical place. And I know the Canadian government withholds 25% or something of her retirement, like her government retirement income things, just for exactly that reason. They sort it out at the end of the year. And then if she gets some of it back, great. Otherwise, she's out. But she makes 25% less than me because of that. So. I mean, part of me just wants to come back tomorrow because, wow, that's, I don't know how you keep that all in your brain. I guess one of the questions that came to me, primarily because I'm looking at your backdrop here, but because you've traveled internationally so much, what are some really nice countries that an American can consider retiring to, even just for half the year, that they won't lose a whole chunk of their money?
Yeah, so that's a difficult one. There's not,
Okay.
there are a few places, but not many, where they won't lose a whole chunk of their money. So some countries, especially in Europe, have programs to attract the American retiree. And those programs are always changing. A very popular one that just went away, it was the Portugal's Golden Visa. So they allowed Americans to come over and be on a special tax treatment plan for 10 years if they had a certain level of financial wealth, so they wouldn't burden down the system there. So a few countries will do programs like that. So you have to be on the lookout for different countries offering those type of different programs where you pay a lot less tax if you come over and retire for, say, 10 years in the country. Italy has a very popular one. If you're an American, you come over and you live in a certain geographical region where they're trying to bolster the economy by bringing in money. Then you can pay a flat 7% tax on your worldwide income and wealth, which is much less than most Americans going to Italy and living outside of those zones would be up in the 45% range for tax. But if you live in one of those zones, it's only 7. So there's pockets here and there. You know, you could go to places like the Emirates, Dubai. They have no tax. You'll still owe tax in America, but you won't have any tax there. But that's generally not a retirement destination for Americans. So Another trick that I'll see a lot of Americans specifically do is instead of staying in one country for a whole year in retirement, they'll only go for part of the year. Most European countries, if you stay over 183 days, half the year, then you trigger your tax residency. So I'll see people spend, 180 days in Portugal and then move for the other 180 days to France or something like that. They'll split their time between two countries so they don't trigger that tax residency in any one country over there. Now it's a little bit of a pain, and as you get older, not settling down and moving country to country, language to language, it gets difficult. But that is a workaround. Other popular countries besides Europe that I see, Costa Rica, Panama, or to Mexico, those are all popular countries to go to south. It keeps people in the same time zone, easy access back to the States for medical purposes and things like that. But it's quite varied. Asia is a growing destination. Thailand, particularly for the cost of living, retirement arbitrage. American dollars go a lot farther in many other places in the world. So a lot of people are looking to go overseas, not just for the cultural aspect, but just to stretch those dollars. Here in Indonesia, where I'm at today, I mean, a quality meal that would be 50 US dollars is around $5 here in Indonesia and Bali. You can really stretch your dollars a lot farther in some places around the world for sure.
Okay, you were talking about Europe there, Italy, Spain, Portugal. Do those countries still operate separately despite the European Union?
Yeah, it's a great question. They do. So even though they're part of the European Union, each country has its own tax authority and their own tax system, tax rates, and they're quite different from one another. They share common similarities, but they're very independent, just like each state in America or each province in Canada, right? You have the federal tax system, but then each state is independent and tax how they want. So it kind of works like that.
Okay, so we've been talking about people moving abroad for retirement, retiring abroad. I'm from Canada. I know people who, come the 1st of November, they want to go somewhere else for five and a half months. I think you can't go over the 6 month, and that changes things up here. How does just relocating for, somebody's living in, I don't know, Idaho. It seems to me that could be a cold place in the winter. And they want to go somewhere a little bit warmer, more exotic, but they're only going to go for 5 months. How does that change their retirements, their 401ks, whatever?
Yeah, great question. If they're going for only partial part of the year, it doesn't change that much. I'm not a Canadian expert, but I know a lot of Canadian, once you're gone more than 6 months, it does affect like your health care benefits and things like that, which we have quite a different system here in the States. So somebody who just wants to leave part of the year and not trigger that tax residency somewhere else, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. That person's still going to be treated as a US citizen. They're still going to owe taxes like they lived in America the whole year. They would still have access to their 401k and their retirement money and all that kind of stuff. Most of the places where people keep their investment money, Charles Schwab, Fidelity, the big custodians, they'll convert their money to euros and send it to a bank for them over in Europe if they need. There's also lots of services like Wise and PayPal that will do those things for people these days as well. That part of living internationally has really gotten easier. Managing the currency risk, changing your money to different currencies and moving it around the world easily, accessing your accounts in your home country, because we can do that through the internet so easily these days to check on things. That part of becoming an international expat type traveler has really gotten a lot easier. But there's still plenty of complications as we've dived into a little bit here for going overseas.
Okay, and I'm going to ask this question, although I'm pretty sure I know the answer. I presume if someone, an American, is going to go for 5 months to somewhere exotic, they still need a permanent address in the States.
So you're not required to have a permanent address in the States, but most Americans would still have their home, or they use a friend's home or their parents or brother or sister. I mean, if you're only going for 5 months, you're still going to keep your bank accounts and those kind of things. So you're still going to have a permanent address in the States.
The reason I ask is, for most of 2025, I was house sitting, And so I did not have, okay, don't laugh. I used to say I slept around. I'm sleeping around, so I don't have a permanent address. But I use my daughter's address as a permanent address, and just because she would always know where I was. So, okay, that answers that. Midlife women, are they particularly vulnerable to some of these hidden risks, and why?
They are. It's a great question. Two reasons. One thing that I find that's still pervasive out there is that women, especially in a couple situation, will rely on the husband. I mean, I'm sure you've covered this topic with other people, to manage the finances and do the savings for retirement, which is generally never a great idea. I always encourage the women to get involved in the finances, understand where things are, what they're doing, what they're on track for, how things are working. It's just smart. It's a smart money move as a couple to have both people understanding what's going on for sure. There's a book, you've probably run across it with a podcast. It's called Don't Worry About a Thing, Dear. Have you ever run across that book?
No, but it scares me already.
Okay,
I'm
so
single, so you can tell that that would scare
right, so I can recommend it's an older book. I think it was written back in the 90s, but it's still very relevant today. You can find it on Amazon. I'm sure you can put a link to it in your show. It's called Don't Worry About a Thing, Dear, and the author escapes me, but if you Google that, it'll come up. And it's exactly what it sounds like, right? The husband will say, "Don't worry about a thing, dear. I've got it all taken care of." And you'd be amazed how many meetings that I have with couples who want to retire in the next couple of years. And now I do most of my meetings through Zoom like this, but especially back when I used to sit down in a physical office 20, 25 years ago with couples, and the wife had really encouraged or pushed the husband to come in and meet with a professional financial planner. And we work through all their stuff and we do a plan, and they are not anywhere near on track for what the husband had thought they were or said they were, right? And it created quite a disruption in the meeting as the wife got emotional and upset with the husband that they weren't on track, that now they're sitting out with a professional, and the husband said, "Oh, we're gonna have $10,000 a month, don't worry about a thing, dear." And really they're on track for $2,000 or $3,000 a month for various reasons. And it's sad as a financial planner to get and see those situations and get into them. But they happen. They happen quite often, for sure, out there. So that's one piece of advice I'd like to give women, is to get involved, understand, take charge. Even if you want your husband to manage all that stuff, just to have a basic knowledge of what's going on in the family finances. And then there's some tax traps that women need to understand that can come out of nowhere and hit them. Statistically, women will outlive men, and in most relationships, the woman is younger, certainly in America, I'd imagine in Canada as well. And so eventually, statistically, they'll become a widow. And we have a thing in America called the widow's penalty. And a lot of women don't learn about that or understand it. And unfortunately, the men don't either, because there's a lot of great men that really want to take care of their wives and do good with their finances. And they just don't learn about these types of things. And the widow's penalty is pretty simple. When you're married in America, you get to file your taxes jointly, and there's benefits to that. You get a higher standard deduction, which is the tax-free amount you get each year in America. The tax brackets are much more generous on what you pay in taxes as a married couple, even if only one person is working. So when the husband passes away and you become a widow, all of a sudden half of your tax-free money that you get each year goes away. All of a sudden, you're in the single tax brackets. And so, even though the income generally doesn't decrease by very much, especially if you've done proper planning, usually only the lower Social Security check goes away. So, in America, if both the husband and the wife are getting Social Security, which is most common in America, when one passes away, male or female, the remaining spouse keeps the higher of the two checks. And in most situations, again, statistically, that's going to be the husband's. And so the wife's Social Security check will go away and she'll move to the higher amount. And that smaller Social Security check is really the only income that goes away, because the woman will inherit the IRAs, she'll inherit the 401ks, she'll inherit the bank accounts. And so the income will continue, almost at the same level, but the tax brackets jump almost double because now they're single and the amount they get tax free gets cut in half. And so now all of a sudden the widow is paying twice as much tax as they were before, and which decreases their standard of living if you're, because a lot more money is going to the government. And so that's one that I see. That's one of the big tax time bombs that I see happen out there that can mostly be avoided with proper financial planning. But people just, I'll tell people, they don't plan to fail. They fail to plan. And maybe you've heard that one before, but it's very true. And unfortunately, then those tax time bombs can have a nasty effect on their life.
Well, and I'm sure it's a case too that it's hard to prepare for something that you don't know exists. So,
yeah.
And I'm going to turn the table on you just a little bit with that. Don't worry about a thing, dear. If you have a couple, and or you know that they're a couple, you've been dealing with the husband because he's been taking care of business. I just used air quotes. And you say, well, you know, does your wife want to know about this, need to know about this? Because you know that he's probably going to predecease her. And he says, oh, no, you know, the little woman trusts me completely. Do you have any recourse to say, well, you know, I'm sure she does, but it'd be a really good idea for her to be in here and understand at least the basics here? Like, can you do that tactfully?
Absolutely. And I'm, to be honest, I'm not that tactful about it. Being tactful is not my strong point. I've gotten better over years, but so personally, as a financial advisor, if both of the couple won't engage in the financial plan, that's a deal killer for me. Just flat out. It doesn't matter how much money they have or how much I like them. If they both won't engage in the financial planning process up front, I decline to work with them. It's just, I think it's that important. Unfortunately, most advisors don't work that way. They love to take a client. A lot of financial advisors, salespeople, you know, I'm lucky I've been doing this 25 years now and in a place where I don't have to take that next client to make my payments at the end of the month. So personally, that's a deal killer for me. And I'll tell them straight up, no uncertain terms, that's how I work and they have to be involved. Now, many times the wife will come in and she'll sit there and she's genuinely not interested. And she does trust her husband. And there's nothing wrong with that. And there's nothing bad going on. But it is a requirement that I have as a financial planner, and they'll sit through the financial planning process and I'll be convinced that they at least understand where they are. And then going forward in a relationship, I'll sometimes only deal with the husband going forward, but I've met her. I understand. I've listened. I've asked my open-ended questions. I know where she's at in the relationship, what her thoughts are financially, making sure that her goals are aligned with the husband's. He understands hers. She understands his, all that kind of good financial planning stuff. And then if she generally doesn't have an interest in being involved, at least I know that she's met me. She's seen how it all works. She understands the situation. And that's definitely enough for me, but it is a requirement that both of them be involved in the beginning of the process if they're going to work with me and my firm.
Yeah, and I can admit that I am one of those people who, bless the souls of my financial advisors, because they understand that as soon as they start talking like really technical financial terms, I just get a little glazed over. And it's not that I don't want to understand, because I really try hard, but because we talk to each other several times a year, they understand that. So they have gotten really good at sort of, okay, now Agnes, this is, you know, this is this and this is that. And if we do this, this is what's going to happen. Or we could do the other thing and that's what's going to happen. And they explain it really carefully. So, you know, for a woman like me, if I had a spouse who I allowed to take care of everything, then yeah, I would still want to be in there just to know that I can talk to you honestly and stuff like that. If he croaks.
Yeah, definitely. And I have mailed copies of that book out to women that I know are in that kind of situation, and not taken them on as a client and just mailed the book out to the house address to the woman. Most of the time, I never know how that ends up because I never hear from them again. But I've untactfully done that before to help people out.
Yeah. I'll put that link to the book in the show notes for sure. Now, we've covered a fair bit here. Are there common mistakes, like financial decisions, that people make and they don't think twice about it, But years up the road, it comes back to bite them.
Absolutely. The most common one for sure. So many people want to put money into these accounts that they can deduct off their taxes this year, not understanding they're just creating a tax problem for themselves down the road. And it's that instant gratification problem that we see creep up all around the world. People, they want to have it now. They want to have as much as they can now. And the older generations, it wasn't long ago when the statistics showed that people retired at 65 and they died at 68. They didn't have a very long retirement. And anytime you could put paying taxes off was a really good idea. And it was back then with that kind of statistics and time frame. These days, though, with people generally having 20 to 30 year type of retirements, everything has changed. And so being taught by that older generation to put off those taxes is no longer, generally speaking, every situation is different, obviously, but generally speaking, good advice. And that's probably the biggest one that I see. I tell people all the time, if you save $100 and you save it in your pre-tax account to save on your taxes today, then you're not really saving that full $100 because the IRS has a lien on that $100 for the taxes you're going to owe on it someday. Right. So if you're in a 20% tax bracket, to make math real easy in this simple situation, your paycheck is going to go up by 20 bucks if you put $100 into your pre-tax account because you're going to get that tax deduction. But what you really just did was save $80 and take a $20 loan from the IRS. And most people don't look at it like that. And they're amazed when they understand that that's really what they're doing. Their paycheck went up by 20 bucks because they put in that pre-tax account. They really only saved 80 bucks because the IRS is always going to get their 20 bucks, right? They're just willing to wait for it. So if you take that out 10 years from now in retirement, and let's just say your $100 is still $100, it hasn't even grown, and you're still in that 20% tax bracket, you're going to owe that $20 back when you take that $100 out. That $20 is going to, the IRS is always going to get their taxes. And so, like I said, you just took a loan. You only saved 80 and you took a $20 loan. You probably didn't save that $20 in your paycheck. You probably just blew it on your lifestyle. And now you get to retirement and you have less than you expect. Where this manifests itself really is people bring me and they say, look, I'm really proud. I'm ready to retire. Here's my 401k statement. They slide it across the desk to me and it says they have $1 million in there. I've saved $1 million. I look at it and I go, I only see $800,000 there. And they're like, what are you talking about? Are your glasses the wrong prescription? There's $1 million there. I'm like, no, there's actually not, because the IRS has already got a lien on 200,000 or more in a lot of situations of that. You actually only own 800,000 of this. The IRS already owns 200,000 of this, and they are going to collect on that money as you take it out in retirement. And that's a big wake-up call for a lot of people. And it gets even worse in my example of saving $100. If by the time you get to retirement, that $100 has grown to $200. Because now, if you're still in that 20% tax bracket, you owe $40 worth of tax on that $20 loan that you took back in the day when you were working, that you blew on dinner, drinks, or the movies, or whatever back in the day. And now you owe $40 in taxes. So it's really a system set up to put money into the coffers of the IRS just so Americans can get some instant gratification today. And it's hardly ever in anybody's best interest to get that extra $20 in their paycheck now so they can pay back 40 or 60 down the road to the IRS in retirement. Now, the big argument I always hear is, well, I'm going to be in a lower tax bracket in retirement. And unfortunately, that's another huge myth, I think, in lots of countries, especially in America. Now, it is true there are some people that get to retirement and they didn't save anything, and maybe they're only living on the government Social Security system and they will be in a lower tax bracket. But mostly the people that I'm going to work with, the people that are listening to a podcast like this, they have an interest in finance. They're savers. It's unlikely that anybody that has any interest working with a financial advisor, listening to a podcast like this, is going to be in a lower tax bracket in retirement. Because they don't want to be, number one, nobody wants to have less money in retirement. When you stop working 40 hours, you generally fill those hours with things that cost money. Most hobbies cost significant amounts of money. And people understand that and they want to plan for it. On top of that, all the things that you do get legitimate deductions for generally go away when you get to retirement. The kid tax credit left when the kids left. the mortgage deductions hopefully are gone because you don't have a mortgage when you get to retirement. So if you are doing pre-tax 401k, all those deductions are gone. Like all these things that helped you in taxes during your work life are generally gone when you get to social, when you get to retirement. Thus, not putting people in a lower tax bracket like they assume they will be. The other issue is it doesn't really matter if you're going to be in a lower tax bracket in retirement. So if we go back to my simple example of saving that $100, and by the time you get to retirement, it's grown to $200, and you've got $20 in tax savings here, and you owe $40 of tax savings there. Now, even if your tax bracket went from 20% in my simple example down to 15%, a 25% reduction, right? You're still going to owe $30. 15% times the $200 is $30 of tax in retirement for that $20 that you saved in your taxes during your working years. So even in that example, the IRS got 50% more money. You saved 20 in your taxes when you put the 100 away. You paid $30 in taxes on that $100, even though your taxes had dropped by 25%. So really, most people are never going to be in a lower tax bracket, or they're not going to be in a low enough tax bracket that it's actually going to save them any money in retirement. It's going to help the IRS, though, and the IRS designed the system exactly like that. Because most people don't learn about it, and they want that small $20 loan today, not realizing it's not really like kicking the can down the road. I'd say it's like pushing that wet snowball down that snowy slope. It's an exponential problem that grows and grows and grows. And if you wait till retirement to try to figure that out, that guy with the $1 million portfolio that really only has 800,000, there's not much he can do about it. He's just gonna have to live with the fact that, man, the IRS has got a lien on this account, and they are going to take a heavy six-figure toll out of my account in retirement now.
What you reminded me of there is in Canada here, we have something called the GIS. It's a guaranteed income supplement. So if your pensions are indeed low enough, the government gives you a top up. But what people don't understand is that, for the first year of retirement, all the Canadian government knows, Canada Revenue knows, is that your last tax year was really lucrative, so you are not going to qualify for any sort of top up. So you've got to get through that year, and a lot of people don't realize that. They just sort of think, oh yeah, well I'll be earning less, so I'll get a top up from the government. Well, actually, no, not this year. So yeah, there's so many facets of that. Now, one thing I was wondering, we've been talking about the IRS, we've been talking about 401ks and Roths and things like that. I know private company pensions are going the way of the dinosaur, but do all those same rules apply if somebody still has a company pension?
So that's a great question. They are going by way of the dinosaur, but they still exist. Most teachers' unions still have a pension.
Okay.
Military people in America have a pension. Most federal workers. So there's quite a large chunk that's still going to get a pension on top of their Social Security in retirement. Now, the thing that really changes that, so I really specialize in tax-free retirement planning. So in most cases, you want to put as much money as you can into tax-free accounts. But if you're not going to get a pension, you want to save still a little bit of money in those tax-deferred accounts. So as much as I say, my $100 example is bad for you, in America, in most countries, you get a certain amount of money income or income each year tax-free. So by putting a little bit of money into those tax-deferred accounts, what I call the ideal number, you can withdraw that in retirement as your tax-free money. And then once you would get into the tax brackets, take from your tax-free accounts. Now the situation completely changes. You get a pension, as you just mentioned, because pensions are 99% of pensions are taxable income, just like you earned at a job. At least they are in America. There are a couple small exceptions. If you get a disability pension from the military, that is tax-free in America, but most pensions are taxable. So that's generally going to make your ideal number go down to zero because you're going to owe taxes on that money. And the little bit of tax-free income that you get in America is going to be eaten up by that pension. So you want to be able to draw the rest of your money from tax-free accounts. So the financial planning process for somebody who's going to get a pension is quite a bit different than somebody who's not going to get a pension in the types of accounts that they want to save and what their ideal number for that tax deferred account versus their tax-free accounts is going to be. It shifts quite a bit if you're going to get a pension.
Okay, so pensions, all those sort of things, Social Security, as you said, somebody's going to come to you. You've got $1 million. I'm ready to retire. It's too late. So technically, what age do you, would you recommend? Like, I mean, as early as your first job, or at least once the family comes along, what age would you recommend people start talking to financial advisors to make sure that all these pitfalls aren't going to slap them upside the head when they decide to retire?
Great question. So I never like to discourage anybody. So I never say it's too late, right? It's never too late. There's lots
Okay.
of things you can do. Now, it might be too late for some of the tax time bombs, but it's never too late for all of them. There's
Exactly.
always things that smart money moves that people can do, and water under the bridge type of concept. The earlier you can learn about this stuff and start, the better, for sure. Now, super young people right out of college, it's good for them to get a basic foundation. Young people, they struggle with money. They don't make a lot of money. It's early in life. Things happen where they often need to take their money out of their retirement accounts. But learning at an early age is really, really important. I try to teach young people all the time, like, don't put your money in that tax deferred account when you're only in the 10% tax bracket. You don't, why create that compounding, that snowball effect we just talked about for, 40 or 50 years of your working life? So that's a big one to teach young people. Also, the tax-free accounts, where if life does happen to you, you just need that money for your car breaks down, or right, and one of those things happen in life. I see, unfortunately, young people, they rob their retirement accounts, and especially in their 20s. It's very common. I did it myself, right? I've made many of the mistakes that I try to teach people now. And if you have your money in a Roth account, at least you can get your own money back out without taxes and penalties to solve that problem. It only adds insult to injury when the government says, okay, well, now we're going to collect that $20 back and we're going to throw an extra $2 penalty on there just because you needed your money before retirement. That doesn't help the young people out whatsoever. So learning this stuff from an early age works really well. So I give out as many copies of my book to young people as I possibly can. I've written a book called Divorce the IRS, and it goes through a lot of these tax time bombs that we're talking about. There's also chapters if you want to live overseas or you've come to America to work. And it's a great first step for young people to understand how the system is set up with good, clear examples of what it looks like, how that $100 savings and that $20 loan compound over time, and what that'll look like when they get to retirement age, and what it would look like side by side if they made different choices at an early age. So the earlier, the better, especially because a lot of the things that we're talking about that solve these problems have limitations. You can't just put $100,000 in a tax-free account. Same in Canada. The government limits the amount of money that you can put into these accounts. So it takes time putting these little bits. This year, you can only put $7,500 into a Roth IRA. It's not a great sum of money, but if you start early in your life putting in $7,500 every year and you let that compounding effect work, it can turn into a big sum of money tax-free for you by the time you get to retirement.
Real quick question there. So I'm just going to round it out here. You're allowed $7,000 a year into your tax-free account. They're not earning very much money for 5 years. In year six, they get the really good job. Can they take all those years and then fill it up, or is it just year by year by year? Because I know here in Canada we can top it up, like we can just.
Yeah, you can. Unfortunately, in America, we cannot. So
Oh.
it's year by year by year.
Okay, I'm glad I asked that question then. Okay, so I mentioned again your person with the $1 million, and it's now only 800,000, and I said it was too late. You said it isn't. How many things are there that people might assume it's too late, but it actually isn't?
Great question. So as you get older, your priorities and what's important to you shift. Now, retirement income is always probably going to be important to you, but there's still goals left in your life that proper financial planning can help. A good example is that widow's penalty. So, in that example, the 65-year-old couple with that $1 million who didn't realize they're going to owe so much to the IRS, right? It's not too late for them. There's still things that they can do because that statistical probability of that widow becoming a widow is probably still 20, 25 years down the road. So there is time for that one. So in that example, they can start utilizing some of the strategies that I outline in my book, like shifting their money from the tax deferred account to the tax free accounts slowly over the first 20 years of their retirement, so that the wife eventually inherits the tax free income instead of that taxable income when her tax brackets are going to get less favorable for her. So that's a good example of there's still time for a major tax time bomb, like the widow's penalty. Another one is paying taxes from the grave, as I like to call it. You know, that, like I said, the IRS is going to tax that money. Even if you die, the IRS is going to tax that money, right? Your kids generally inherit your accounts when they're in the highest income brackets of their lives. Generally, in their 50s is when most kids in America will inherit their parents' money. And the way the IRS does it is they say you have to take all your parents' money out of those tax deferred accounts within 10 years of death. And you have to put it on top of your income from work and pay taxes on it. So unfortunately, you know, mom and dad might have been in a 10% tax bracket in retirement, but the kids are successful. And now that the kids have to take all mom and dad's money out of those accounts and put it on top of their very successful working year income, you know, that money now might get taxed at 30%, where mom and dad were only paying 10% on it. Another tax time bomb, the IRS. I mean, the IRS knows the kids are going to inherit that money when they're still earning their money, right? It's all set up as a system to for the IRS to take advantage of people who don't understand how it all works. So in that example, again, still plenty of time. A 30-year retirement, that 60-year-old, 65-year-old couple still has plenty of time to start making switches to the tax-free accounts. There's lots of other financial planning strategies that you can use to eliminate that problem as well, paying taxes from the grave. So there's always time to still make good financial decisions in life.
This is great because you will say something and it's like, okay, well, what about this? So what about this? You know, say mom's alone now and she's got her all her tax-free and all the savings accounts going. She gets diagnosed with cancer. She's got a good length of time. She's got 3 to 4 years. Is it advisable to set up like a joint bank account and start funneling that into with her one her kids or one, whatever she's got, so that when she dies, it's because it's a joint account, it becomes their account. Does that help defer any of that?
It can. Each situation is different. So we have gifting rules and gifting taxes in America as well. So there's only so much that you can gift to your kids without taxes. You cannot gift or put your kids on like your IRA or your 401k or your pre-tax accounts. Those are individual retirement accounts, right? So you can't do that. That strategy also, since we started this conversation talking about expats, also gets more complicated because as soon as you put your, you know, mom and dad are retired in Italy, they want to put their kids on the account. Now the kids have all these new tax reporting requirements because mom and dad are overseas, but their name is on some of the accounts. That creates a whole ball of worms for the kids then, for the foreign reporting and all that kind of stuff on their personal taxes. So there are certainly situations where you can do things like that, also using trusts and things like that to help with the taxes. And in many of those cases, we would get an estate attorney involved with creating those trusts and wills and power of attorneys and all those kind of things. So we're always trying to help clients maximize what they keep and pay legally as little as possible to the IRS. But each situation is different on what you can and can't do.
You said a ball of worms. My thought was more like a hornet's nest because you can really get stung. Okay, so we've got a listener out there right now who has been considering going retiring to Portugal or something. I just talked to somebody recently who retired to the north of Spain. She's an American. And, you know, they're a little nervous now having listened to this conversation. What's one step they could take? Because this won't happen for 2 years. Is there a step they could take right now that could get them started into a good path for drawing their money?
Yeah, absolutely. There's lots of resources out there for people who are going to move overseas or thinking about moving overseas to start to educate themselves of what that would look like, what their new requirements would be. I have a chapter in my book about it. On my website, you can download a free guide, quite a comprehensive guide for Americans that want to go overseas and all the different issues they want to think about and educate themselves on. And there's several other companies that do exactly what I do that are great at helping clients go overseas. And tools like ChatGPT have become also very good at going out there and figuring out what the tax complications are in a certain country and being able to compare it to what your situation here is in America. So there's lots of resources for somebody who wants to learn about this stuff, whether they end up wanting to do it themselves and they have an interest in it, or hiring somebody like me to help them along the way. It's all possible.
Do you use ChatGPT?
I do. It's made most financial advisors these days are using AI type tools to become more efficient. And a lot of people ask me kind of a separate thing here. Do you think that thing AI is going to replace financial advisors? Are you worried about that?
Yeah, no.
And
And that the
I'm
direction I was taking is more, I use AI, and I know that, like, because you were talking about, like, just the average person on the street possibly using AI. I know that I have got to guide it. I have got to give it parameters. I have got to really, really be specific in my prompts. Is there a chance that just somebody off the street could not be that specific and it doesn't work out because they don't get the right information?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you can't trust everything that AI comes up with or the internet comes up with as well. So it's always a good idea to do your preliminary research on the internet so you understand. And then so if you can work with a professional who's been doing it for a long time, has lived overseas themselves, understands the system to marry up that information that you've learned on your own to make sure that you're doing it correctly.
Yeah. As I say, the more I use it, the more I realize that I ought to be so specific. As a friend of mine recently said, my AI seems to like a dominatrix. Okay, I have one more question. I see articles regularly about the cost of living in other countries. Sometimes it's great, sometimes it's like, holy crap. But in your experience, do people relocate for lifestyle or for the reduced cost of living in other countries in retirement?
Great question. Both. So you can break people into two groups. Somebody who's saved a considerable amount of money, they're going to be okay. They generally are relocating for the culture, the experience. And then there's another whole group that's relocating that didn't save as much as they wish they had, which really everybody feels that way. Even the people with a lot of money always say they wish they'd saved more, right? Don't we all? But they're relocating that group of people because they're trying that lifestyle arbitrage. And which really became a big thing with the Tim Ferriss book a number of years ago, The 4-Hour Workweek, which was quite a bestseller. A lot of your listeners are probably listening to that. He was the guy that really started talking about this lifestyle arbitrage where your money could really go farther overseas. And when that came out, that part of my business really ticked up as people were looking to stretch their dollars in lower cost places around the world. And there's still a large group of people that are seeking exactly that out. Maybe they only have their social security check and they're looking for a place where it'll go much farther than in the States.
I'm watching the clock here, but you keep on giving me questions. So, if someone is, I don't know, 50, the kids are gone, they're thinking about retiring to Bali or like a European country, is there a possibility that now, while they're still earning really good money, they could start setting up accounts in another country? Or is that going to come back to bite them as well, just so that they've got a good chunk of cash there when they get there?
Yeah, good question. Generally, it'll come back to bite them. So for Americans specifically, they want to keep all of their investments is in America, even if they're going to leave America for the rest of their life. Because once you move your investments outside of America, the IRS does not tax them as favorably as when they're inside America. And the IRS does that purposely so that people won't try to tax evade. by moving their money overseas. So for generally for Americans going overseas, bank accounts are fine. You can certainly have a bank account overseas. If there's more than $10,000 in an overseas bank account on any single day of the year, you do have to file the FBAR form in America and report that bank account to the IRS. Real estate is also okay. So that 50-year-old couple you just described, they might want to think about buying a property if they know they're going to go somewhere eventually overseas. That's okay. There's not a lot of extra tax reporting to buy a property, and no, certainly no penalties or anything like that. Now, if they're going to rent out that property that while they're waiting to retire to generate some income in that other country, now they've got some cross-border tax issues that can get a little bit complicated, but manageable. But as far as moving their investments, they're going to want to, even after they've moved to Portugal or Bali or wherever it is, they're still going to keep their investment accounts inside of America for the better tax treatment, generally from both countries. Most countries aren't looking to get people to move their investments over to those countries. They're happy to tax. If you're living in Italy, they're happy to tax your investments even if they stay in America. They don't need it moved over to Italy to tax them if you're a tax resident there.
Okay, I want to tell our listeners that Jimmy has come up with an answer without even glancing at his other monitor. Is there a question that somebody could ask you today that you would say, "Let me look that up"? I'm so impressed with, oh my goodness, you know your stuff.
Thank you. I've been doing this a long time. And of course, there's many questions that people could ask me. And I'm very honest with people. I'm not embarrassed to say, look, I don't know the answer to that. Would you like me to make something up, or would you like me to get back to you on that one? Yeah, there's, I get questions on funky countries. The countries we've been talking about, I already have lots of clients in. I deal with the tax treaty on a daily. But somebody came and said, I really want to retire in Kazakhstan or some way. make a weird small country like that. I wouldn't be, I would have to do the research to help them. I wouldn't be familiar with that tax treaty if there even is one. So yeah, there's definitely a lot of questions that I would have to go research for sure.
Okay. You've been teasing us throughout this conversation. Tell us about your book.
I decided during the COVID lockdowns, right? We all had all this inside time that might be productive to write a book, because I've always wanted to be an author. So I wrote a book. I took a look at all the content that I'd ever put out there as an advisor and kind of brought it all together into one book called Divorce the IRS. And it's a book that kind of, the first third of the book kind of explains basic tax concepts and breaks some of the myths, like that you're going to be in a lower tax bracket in retirement, like we discussed, for example. So it gives you a good foundational start to understanding the system. The middle part of the book talks about the eight tax time bombs or tax traps. We've hit on several of them today, like paying taxes from the grave, the widow's penalty, those kind of things, and what to do about them. And then the back third of the book talks about in depth all the strategies that you can use, the ideal number, shifting your money to tax-free accounts. There's some case studies in there, a case study for somebody early in life, midlife, and at retirement. And there's a one for if you have a pension, since you asked about that. And then the book ends with people who want to do specific stuff overseas. It's available on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, independent bookstores. It's in the second edition. It did so well that I put a second edition out last year with updated tax numbers and things like that. It's a quick and easy read. As easy as reading about taxes can be. I understand that reading about taxes is not the most fun. There's a podcast for the book as well, Divorce the IRS podcast, you can search out. It's a great foundational beginning to start to learn about all these things that we've discussed today.
And I just flashed over to your website here. You've got free guides as well, and they look like they'd be really handy.
Absolutely. So I come personally from a theory of abundance, not scarcity. So I am, as you can tell from this, I'm free. I'm happy to help people. I'm happy to give away my knowledge. Some people are going to take it and do great things with it, and that really makes me happy as a human being. And then some people will learn and still want professional help, and they'll want to work together and become clients. That also makes me happy. Right. So yeah, there's a tremendous amount of resources on my website, on my YouTube channel. I give all of that stuff away for free. I'm always happy to do that for most clients that qualify. I also do financial planning for free. I'm a little bit different than a lot of advisors there. I don't think somebody should make a decision on whether they should work with an advisor, me or anybody else, off a quick Zoom call these days. I give out the financial plan, all the strategies and everything completely for free so that people can make a real educated decision on whether they want to work with somebody like me, and they can see all the value in it. And I'm equally happy if they take that and run with it on their own. That's a good referral source generally, or if they decide to work with me. Like there's lots of people out there that need help with this kind of stuff, and I'm happy to do so.
So you're nodding away. Where do we find you on the World Wide Web?
Yeah, so I have two websites, baobabwealth.com, generally for the US-based clients, and baobabwealthabroad.com for the expats. Baobab, most people, what's that? It's the tree of life. You might have seen it in The Lion King. That's where it kind of got famous. I was born in Zambia, where the baobab tree lives, and I like to use the tree as the analogy for my company because the baobab tree is one of the longest living and strongest trees in the world. And I always say investing is often like planting a tree. You start with a seed and you just give it time and leave it alone. It grows into something beautiful like the baobab tree. So that's why I use that for my logo. But those two websites, and from there you can find the guides and my YouTube channel and all that kind of stuff for lots of free resources.
Okay, yeah. My next quick question would have been social. I see Facebook, YouTube, and
Correct.
LinkedIn. Okay, that's great. Can I ask you a personal question before we close?
Absolutely.
So you've been traveling most of your lifetime. You're living internationally. Is there a place in the world that still feels like a deep exhale when you arrive, like home, and why is that?
Yeah, it's different places for different reasons, right? So it's a great question. It always feels good to come home to America. I mean, I'm an American
Okay.
through and through. I really have Alaska holds a special place in my heart. I'm an outdoorsy type guy. So I like to come home just to America, but specifically Alaska in general. We also like Florida. As I get older, Alaska's a little cold in the winter. But yeah, so for city life, when I really want to do city life, I don't think that there's a better city on planet Earth than Moscow, to be honest. I lived in Moscow for 4 years. That answer surprises a lot of people. What a great city, great people, lots of culture, largest city in Europe. A lot of people think London or Paris, but Moscow is actually the largest city in Europe, 22 million people. So for city life, Moscow is amazing. For outdoor stuff, if I'm not in America, the South Island of New Zealand just gives me that feeling, the mountains, the glaciers, the hiking, the fishing. And for quality of life, I would say Australia is where I like to go for just want to kick back and have high quality of life. And Bali here in Indonesia is a really great place for stretching those dollars. Feeling constrained, I want to stretch those dollars. So different places have different benefits. And being as global as I am, different places have appeal for different reasons.
Very nice. Okay. People are going to take notes on that last bit alone. Okay. Your website link is in the show notes. All the links are on your page at our website. Listeners, if someone you know is thinking about living abroad, retiring overseas, or just wants to avoid financial surprises down the road, this is one of those conversations worth passing along. If conversations like this matter to you, I'd love it if you followed the podcast so these thoughtful, practical discussions find you when you need them. Quick reminder to check out the resource tab at boomwithabang.com. There's a lot of stuff there. If I've missed anything you need or want to see, let me know and I'll make sure it happens. Jimmy Miller, thank you for being my guest today, helping us to see how today's financial choices, I guess, can shape not just our future, but give us the freedom to live the life we want to live. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure.
Have a great rest of week.
Thank you, you too.